Okay, we're beginning here with the Mishnah on the top of Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph. Mishnah says, Amar Lishnaim says to two individuals, Gazalti le'achad mikem maneh. I stole from one of you 100 zuz. Ve'eni yodeya eze mikem. And I don't know which one of you I stole from. Oh, Aviv shel achad mikem hifkid li maneh. One of your fathers deposited 100 zuz with me. Ve'eni yodeya eze hu. I don't know which one, I don't know which father did that. So in the case of Gezel, it's possible that the individuals themselves don't know who stole from them. So or that even they were stolen from. It might be they're not aware at all. In the case of Pikadon, it's harder to argue that they wouldn't be aware or have no information. Therefore, we speak about their fathers doing the deposit, because then they may not be aware of the information. Noten lezemaneh lezemaneh. He gives each one of them 100. Because he voluntarily admitted to the problem. Again, the Gemara will deal with why that is. Why just by the fact that he admitted by himself, does that obligate him to pay both parties? But he, according to the Mishnah, pays both parties once he's admitted either that he had this deposit or he has this gezel in hand. Two individuals who deposited with this single individual. Zemaneh v'zematayim. One of them gave 100, and the other one deposited 200. Ze omer sheli matayim, veze omer sheli matayim. They each say that the 200 belongs to them. Noten lezemaneh, or lezemaneh. He gives 100 zuz to each party because, at minimum, that's what they're entitled to. Vashayeh munach, ashivo Eliyahu. And the 100 that's in dispute, he'll leave until Eliyahu comes, and that we'll keep it in escrow until we can either prove that one of the two parties is entitled to it, or until the Yahu Navi comes and clarifies the situation for us. Ramban asks, in this case, why isn't this the equivalent of a modeh b'miktzat situation? Which is that the individual has deposits with him. Two parties come and say, you owe me 200. He says, look, I owe 200 to one of you. I owe 100 to the other one. So in one case he's agreeing, in the other case he's modeh b'miktzat. If he's modeh b'miktzat, then he has a shvuah that he has to take. He can't take the shvuah. That would obligate him then to pay because he can't take the shvuah. The answer is somewhat obvious, which is that in the case of modeh b'miktzat, there's a claim against him and he denies the claim. Meaning that he's holding on to some value that supposedly was deposited with him. In this case, the nifkad is disgorging everything that was given to him. He's willing to give back the entire 300. The only question is between the other two parties, they have a disagreement as to whom the 200 belongs to, and the 100 belongs to. But as far as he's concerned, he's disgorged everything, so there's no modeh b'miktzat because he's willing to give all 300 away. So in that way, the Ramban says that there is no shvuah modeh b'miktzat in this case because it's not really the classic case of modeh b'miktzat where you're denying and holding on to a portion of what you otherwise would have owed to the other party, because here you're disgorging all of it. Amar Rabbi Yossi, so now this is why the Mishnah is found here, is because Imkain mahif sidar amai. What loss is the cheater incurring? Because in the case here, the cheater has no downside. He comes along and he says, the 200 belongs to me. At minimum, he's going to get 100, which is what he deposited anyway. The upside is he might actually get the 200. So there's no downside and all upside. Ella, akol yehe munach ajivo Eliyahu. Yossi says, you keep the entire 300 in escrow until Eliyahu Navi comes and determines who it belongs to. Because now the Ramai loses out. The Ramai in this situation has downside. He won't get his 100 back. So he has to think twice before he makes a claim for the 200. Because once he does that, he's not going to get anything back. He's not going to get the original 100 back. So now he has a downside. He has upside of 100, but also downside of 100. It's a deterrent from him making a false claim because he will lose his money in that case when it goes to a stalemate with the other party. But the problem is not with the guy who wants his 200. The problem is with the guy who is trying to take the 200 from the other individual. If we can deter him from lying, the other guy will get his money. So yes, we're penalizing both parties, but in the end, we're trying to deter the guy from lying. V'chein shnei kelim. And the same is true with two utensils. Echad yafe maneh, v'chad yafe elef zuz. One's worth 100 zuz, one's worth 1,000 zuz. Zeomer yafe sheli, v'zeomer yafe sheli. Each one of them claims the 1,000 zuz. Keli, notein et akatan le'echad mehem. He gives the smaller kli to one of them. Mitocha gadol, notein d'mei katan le'sheni. And through the larger utensil, he pays the value of the katan to the second one. V'hashar yeh munach ad shivo Eliyahu. And the remainder will be kept in escrow until Eliyahu Navi comes and clarifies the situation for us. Rashi, interesting enough, says over here, mitocha gadol ishberenu. He will break the gadol and then give a piece of the gadol to compensate for the katan. And then he'll keep the rest in escrow. Other Rishonim, the Ritva and others say that, why would you break the kli in order to give it to him? You could destroy all of its value. And so you would sell the kli, monetize it, and then give him the value of the katan. Rashi is heavily influenced by the Gemara, which we'll see, and that's probably why he interpreted it as being Ishvarenu. But there is an opinion like the Meiri who suggests a in-between position here, which is that depends on the nature of the kli. There's certain kelim, if you break them, then they lose all their value. So obviously there you would monetize it, you'd sell it. On the other hand, there are a kelim, or let's call it a bar of gold, or something where breaking it or subdividing it doesn't cause a loss of value because there's inherent value in the object itself. So there's a possibility that we're talking about two different types of kelim, and in that way you could explain sometimes that you break it and sometimes that you sell it. Amar Rabbi Yossi, once again, he says, Im kein ma yifsida ramai. What downside does the cheater have over here? Ela kol yeh munach ad shivo Eliyahu. The whole thing be left until Eliyahu Navi comes, in order that we have a deterrent for the ramai from lying, because he'll lose his money, he'll get nothing back. Now the truth is, in this case, it's a little different than the previous case. In the previous case, he deposited 100, and now he's making a claim for 200. When you withhold all the money from him, he has upside of 100, downside of 100. He really has to think before he does it. In this scenario where there's a kli of 100 and a kli of 1,000, then when he makes the claim, his upside is 900 and his downside is 100. So there is maybe a difference in the cases. In both cases, Rabbi Yossi says that the deterrent is that he will lose all of his money. But the truth is that at a certain point, it's like buying a lottery ticket, which is that the upside's worth enough that even if you take away his property, that he might be willing to risk it to get the larger kli. But in the end, Rabbi Yossi's basic thesis is that if you take away his possibility of retrieving any of his money, he'd rather just get his money back and not risk it to lie and then get into a stalemate with the other party and not get anything back. According to the Chachamim, whatever we know for certain, we're going to return. Whatever is the safek, that we withhold until we can clarify the safek about that item. Alma, from our Mishnah, it makes it sound like misfeka mafkina mimona, that misafek, we extract money. In the Reisha, we say that the individual admits to some wrongdoing or to the fact that something was deposited to him. In the end, he pays out more money than he ever stole, or he pays out more money than ever was deposited with him. That means that we are extracting money from him that we don't have necessarily proof to, or that we have any reason to believe that he owes that money. And we don't say that the chazakah should govern over here. Generally, we say that when it comes to monetary matters, that chazakah governs unless there is a raya, a proof otherwise. And so you have a motzi mi chaveiro alav raya. The motzi is always the one who's trying to undermine the chazakah, which is the person in possession of the object. So over here, the individual who stole, or the individual had these items deposited with him, the money is now sitting with him. We're saying, give up that money, not only the money that you stole, but double the money you stole, because you're going to pay both parties. So we're, in a sense, taking away his money without any proof, even though he is the one in possession of the money. Viramini, is that really true? Shnayim shif gidu etzel echad, zimane v'zimatayim. So what about the latter half of our Mishnah? The latter half of our Mishnah where there's a deposit of 100 and a deposit of 200, zeo mer shali matayim, zeo mer shali matayim, each one claims 200, noten lezemaneh lezemaneh, you get one of them 100, v'shayim minach ad shivo Eliyahu, and the remainder will be there in safek or in escrow until Eliyahu Navi comes and clarifies it. So now in the seifa of the Mishnah, it looks like you leave the money b'chezkato, which is that we don't make him pay 200 to each party. We say he pays 100 to each party, leaves 100 between them, and let them figure it out. So then, in a Reisha case, why don't you say the same thing? Let him give the 100 back and let the other two parties work it out. So, amalei pikadon akezel karomit. Wait a minute. You are mixing and matching cases. The case that you brought in the beginning, the ratio of our Mishnah, is a case of gezel. The case that you brought in the latter half of the Mishnah is a case of pikadon, of a deposit. Gezel davadi surah kansura bonan. By the gezel, where he did something wrong, the Rambanan imposed a knas on him because of the fact that he violated an Isur. He stole from someone. Therefore, we make him pay both parties back. Pikadon, the law of Isura, in the case by the pikadon where somebody deposited with him and he didn't do anything wrong, lo kansura Rabbanan, the Rabbanan weren't kones him. And even though in general we have a takanat hashavim, which is that we try to enhance or make it easier for the individual to return an item, so that's impetus for us to go easy on the gazlan. Over here, we're doing just the opposite. We're being kones the gazlan, which makes it harder for him to do tshuva, because now he has to pay two parties instead of one party. In a sense, you are disincentivizing him from admitting, and it's the opposite of takanat shavim. So the Rosh over here says the reason is because this is different than your classic case of takanat shavim. By your classic case of takanat shavim, the principal amount is returned to the nigzal. So as long as the nigzal is made whole, we're okay with being lenient with the gazlan. On the other hand, over here, we have a fundamental problem, which is we don't know if the nigzal is going to get his money back. And in that case, if we institute a takanat shavim, where we tell him, disgorge the money and then leave it and they'll figure it out, that means that the nigzal may never get his money back. In that case, we're not going to help the gazlan out. We're not going to benefit the gazlan at the expense of the nigzal. Even though the truth is that in certain cases, in Bava Kamma, we saw that was happening, which is that takanat shavim made it that the gazlan is actually benefiting at the expense of the nigzal in order to facilitate the return of the principal amount. And that's the key element over there. In Bava Kamma, in all the cases where the nigzal lost out, quote-unquote, that was beyond the principal amount. As long as we got him back the principal amount, what was above the principal amount, we were willing to sacrifice in order to get the person to do tshuva and return the gezel. But we never ate into the principal amount in order to facilitate takanat shavim. And so the otu over here. Here, if the individual doesn't get the principal amount back, then there's no reason for the takanat shavim, because then the nigzal is really out his principal amount. The way that the Gemara is doing this is partial disclosure. They're giving you half the facts and saying, oh, it's not a question. The truth is that in our Mishnah, there were two cases in the Reisha. There's a case of gezel and a case of pikadon. So, were you telling me now that, oh, you're talking about gezel in the Reisha and pikadon in the Seifa? The Reisha has a case of pikadon as well. And that's what the Gemara says. For Rami pikadon a pikadon. You could ask a stira and pikadon in our Mishnah. Rami gezel a gezel. And we can ask on gezel as well. There we'll have to bring an outside source. Pikadon a pikadon niktani Reisha. The Reisha of our Mishnah says, O aviv shelachad mikem ifkid etzli maneh, ve'eni yodeh eizeh hu, noten lezeh maneh, ve'zeh maneh. I don't know which one of you it belongs to. He has to pay each one of them 100 zuz. Ve'rimini. And then what about the second half of our Mishnah, which says, shnaim shifkidu, two individuals who deposited with him. So here you have a stira in the Mishnah as to whether the individual who has the deposit with him has to repay both parties, or he only has to repay each party up to the minimum amount and leave the rest between them. How do we deal with the differences between the Reisha and the Seifa? The Gemara says, Amarava, Reisha naseh kemishif gidolo b'shnei krichot. The Reisha is a case where it's the equivalent of two different packages being deposited with him. Dehavale the Medak, he should have been more careful about it. Seifa naseh kemishif gidolo b'krach echad. The safe is a case where there was one deposit to him to overlay the medak. He shouldn't have been careful with it. Kagon, what is a case like that? Tavkidu tavayu badei adodi b'chad zimno. So both of them came to deposit the money at the same time. Damar lehu, because he can say to them, ant gufaychu lo kaptitu adodi. He says, you two did not care about each other because you were willing to disclose the information or deposit the money in front of the other party. Ana kabdinda, I should be careful about it. So the way that Rava differentiates between the ratio of the Mishnah and the Seifa of the Mishnah is to say, who is responsible for knowing, or who is responsible for the fact that there's a difference in the values? In the Reisha case, especially because of Aviv, it came from their parents, there's no way that the parties are going to know who gave the deposit or how the deposit was made. That means that the sole responsibility lies with the Nifkad, the one who was holding the property. Since it's his responsibility, and he's failing at that responsibility, he now has to pay each party in order to discharge his obligation, because the Safek derives from his failure. And so therefore he has to pay both parties back. In the Seifa case, he is not the one responsible for knowing which person gave 200 and which gave 100, because when it was deposited with him, both parties deposited it together, and they're both aware of each other's deposit. And so he can say to them, listen, when you guys came to deposit, you weren't so careful as not to disclose the information in front of the other individual, and therefore you can't say to me, I need to be careful about this. I assumed you guys trusted each other. That means that when you came to pick it up, you also trusted each other. So you guys gave me 300 in front of each other. I kept it together as 300. I don't have to remember who gave the 200 and 100. That's between you guys, because you guys trusted each other. It could be that they gave it to him separately, and he did know at the time. But the fact that they gave it together at the same time, and each one is aware of the other party's deposit, means that the other party knows that you could lie about it. If you know the other guy 200 and 100, you know the other guy can come along and claim the 200. The fact that you did that shows that you weren't worried about that circumstance. So now, why do I have to remember? Now, if you gave it to him separately, in separate transactions, he would be responsible to remember which belongs to whom, and he would have to repay them because that was his responsibility. The information wasn't disclosed in front of each other. Here, the case is the equivalent of, that's what Rova is saying, they gave him a sack with 300 in it. Of course, in that case, he doesn't need to know who's the 200, who's the 100. They gave him a sack of 300. So here they didn't literally give him a sack of 300, or could have been that, but they gave him in a way that it looks like a sack of 300, which is that they gave it together when they were both there. One guy walks into him, the other guy walks in at the same time. One guy goes, I'm giving you 100, the other guy says, I'm giving you 200. That's the equivalent of giving it to him in a single sack, because the other parties are aware of each other. That means that they know that the other party can come and steal or make a claim for his 200. And for that reason, he says, I'm not responsible to remember. I'm not responsible for the fact that you guys trusted each other. You guys work it out. It has nothing to do with me. So Mar says, Rami Gezel HaGezel. And even within Gezel, we have a Stira. Tani Hocha, our Mishnah says, Amar Deshtayim Gezalti Echad Mikem, Mane, I stole from one of you 100, Ven Yodea is a Mikem, and I don't know which one of you, O Aviv Shel Echad Mikem, Hifkidli Mane, Ven Yodea is who? I don't know which one it was. Notein Lezeh Mane, Lezeh Mane. Give each one of them 100. So in that case of Gezel, we say that he has to pay out to all parties. Beremini, we have another case where Gezel Echad Mechamisha stole from 1 out of 5. Ven Yodea is a man Gezel. He doesn't know which one he stole from. V'zeh omer oti gazal, v'zeh omer oti gazal. Every one of them is making a claim and saying, you stole from me, you stole from me, you stole from me. He knows he only stole from one of them. But all 5 of them are making a claim that you stole from me. Meniach gzeila b'neem v'nistalek divrei Rabbi Tarfon. He puts down the gzeila and says, you guys work it out. I can't work it out here. You guys work it out because I only stole from one person. Obviously, 4 of you are lying over here. So, Alma, Misveika, lo mafkina mamona. Over here, it seems that from Safek, you're not mafkia mamona. We don't make him pay all 5 parties. We simply tell him, put it down, and they'll have to deal with it themselves. Ve'amrinan, ukim mamona, bechezkat mare. And we say, leave the money with the party that's in control of it. That means that the gazlan keeps his money, except for the 100, which he's certain he stole, that he disgorges. And our Mishnah says that he has to give money to each one of the parties. So now, before we get into the question itself, you have to determine whether it is a question. Remember, we quoted our Mishnah, and then we quoted a position of Rabbi Tarfon. So that means that you have to assume that our Mishnah is also like Rabbi Tarfon. Because if you simply prove that our Mishnah is not Rabbi Tarfon, you can answer the question and say, that's Rabbi Tarfon. Our Mishnah is not like Rabbi Tarfon. That'd be the easiest answer. And that's what the Gemara asks now. How do you know that our Mishnah is also authored by Rabbi Tarfon? Diktani Allah, because we have a Braita that qualifies this Mishnah. The Gahi Mode Rabbi Tarfon. In this situation, Rabbi Tarfon agrees. Pomer l'shnayim gazalti l'echad mechem maneh. If I, he says to 2 people, I stole from one of you a maneh. Ven yodei zeh mikem, and I don't know which one of them. Neshonotein l'zeh maneh l'zeh maneh. So we see Rabbi Tarfon himself makes a statement that is equivalent to our Mishnah. So Rabbi Darfon himself, who says that in a case where five people come to make a claim and he says, I only stole from one of you, he puts the money between them, lets them work it out. He agrees to what our Mishnah says. That if he says, I stole from one of you two guys, then he has to pay back each one of the individuals. So why do we have a difference there? Why in one case do we leave the money b'chezkat marei with the owner? In the other case, we force him to give up money that is otherwise in his possession that he clearly doesn't owe. We know he only stole once, and he's admitting to the fact that he stole once, yet we're making him pay twice. Why is that? Or what's the difference between the cases? As the Baal Yetzer HaSofot point out over here, this is not because of the difference of Bari and Shema. We know that there's a machloket with regards to Bari and Shema, whether Bari and Shema is enough of a reason to say that the person who makes the Bari, their clear claim, gets to keep the money, or he, the Shema, has to disgorge the money. Or is Bari and Shema still not enough evidence of the fact that you have to pay? That's a machloket that we saw at the end of Baba Kama. You could argue here that the difference between these cases is Bari v'Shema. So what Tosafot points out is that that has no influence in this scenario. And that is that in the case of one who stole and five people come and make a claim against him, over there, even though all five are making a Bari claim, a definitive claim, and he doesn't know, and he's saying Shema, he still doesn't have to pay all five of them. Even according to the one who says that generally by Bari and Shema, you have to pay. Because over here, he knows one piece of information for sure. That is, he doesn't owe all five of them. He doesn't know which of the five, but he knows for certain that he doesn't owe all five of them. And therefore, in terms of the money itself, it's a Bari v'Bari. The Shema is who the money belongs to, but as far as the claim is concerned, it's a Bari v'Bari. And the same is true in our case. When he comes and he admits to the fact that he owes the money, then even though that might be a case of Shema and Shema, because he says, maybe I stole, I don't know who I stole from, the other guys don't know if they were stolen from. Over here again, even in this case, there still is a reason to believe that he owes the money because he admits he owes someone the money. It's not a case of Shema and Shema, we just leave everything in place, because over here he admits that he stole. So one thing we know for certain is that he has stolen money in his possession. So now, if he has stolen money in his possession, he's got to disgorge it. How he disgorges it, that's what we have to determine. Is to give both parties or one party. And therefore, Tosafot points out that Bari and Shema don't play a role over here because they're not influential in the outcome of the case because it's not your classic cases of Bari and Shema because of the information that we know, which is that in one case we know for certain that he didn't steal from five people. In the other case, we know for certain that he did steal from one person. So both of those will influence the case. And therefore, you have a machloket Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Tarfon as to how you solve the problem. But now we have this stira. The answer is, Hotam katavile, hocha bevalitzei yidei shamayim. The difference between the cases is in the case of the one to the five, there they are making a claim against him. They are demanding payment. Five people are coming along and said, you stole from me, pay me back. Over here in our Mishnah, nobody's making a claim against him. He's voluntarily offering to make pay back the money that he stole. Dekanami. That makes sense. You can even daik that from the Lashon, Diktani, Shehudem, Yipiatzmo, Shma Mino. Our Mishnah says that he admitted to the fact that he stole. So the case of the five people making claim against the one, over there the five are coming and claiming against him. And so now when he was to repay the money, he knows he stole only from one of them. And all of their claims are not true. So that's when he takes the money out and says, you guys work it out. I'm disgorging the gezel. But you guys are going to have to work out between you who gets the money, at least according to Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Akiva disagrees with that. Now, in our Mishnah, where it says that you pay back each party, that's a case where he's admitting of his own volition that he stole, and now he wants to make good on the fact that he stole. Let's say it's Yedei Shamayim. In order to be Yotzei Yedei Shamayim, then he has to pay each party back. Because until the Nigzal receives his principal, he hasn't discharged his obligation. Which is, yes, he can disgorge the gezel. But disgorging the gezel is only one step in the process. That means you're no longer in possession of the stolen item. But you have another obligation, which is to return the item to the person you stole it from. So in that case, returning the item, you're not going to do that unless you pay both parties. That's why we obligate him to pay both parties. So that way he is, let's say, Yedei Shamayim. He's certain not only has he disgorged the gezel, but now he's returned it to its rightful owner. In the case of the five, he's not trying to be, let's say, Yedei Shamayim. He's simply, what is the din? The din is that if these guys all come and make a claim against you, and you know for certain you don't owe them all money, then you let them work it out. You disgorge the gezel. You let them work it out. Again, Rabbi Akiva makes a statement over there and says, by that method, you're not going to be Yotze Yedei Shemayim. And therefore, you have to pay all five parties. But that's the idea, meaning that if you want to be Yotze Yedei Shemayim, you're going to have to pay all the parties. If you want to know what the Ikar Din is, then you just have to disgorge the gezel and let the parties work out who's the real owner, who it rightfully belongs to. Now, over here, what's interesting is that this answer could serve as an answer for the first case as well. Remember, Rova differentiated between the case of Pikadon and the Reisha and Pikadon and the Seifa by saying Pikadon and the Reisha is a case where they deposited separately, or he should have known the information. And the case in the Seifa is a case where they deposited together and he didn't have the obligation to know the information. The truth is, you could have answered the same way we answer for Gezel, which is the Reisha is a case where he's Yotze Yedei Shemayim, therefore he pays both parties back, even though he knows only one party deposited with him, but he wants to do the right thing and get the party their money back, so he pays both of them. In the latter case, it's a case where they're coming and claiming against him. Each guy claims that he has 200 of mine. So in that case, his response is, I'll give you each 100, you work out the 100 between you. He doesn't have any obligation to give them more than he thinks that he has here. He's not trying to be in the Yotze Yedei Shemayim. So you could have answered the same thing in the Reisha. Tosafot raises that specter and says, maybe now what the Gemara is saying is that what Rava said before is not true, and this is the answer for both parts of the Mishnah. Tosafot says that's not the case here because of the fact that the Gemara does not use the language of Ella. We've discussed this before, that whenever the word Gemara uses the word Ella, Ella means that we have rejected what was before, and now we're trying a new approach over here. So Tosafot says that if it was true that this answer was answering both questions of the Mishnah, it should have been Ella. The word Ella should have preceded the statement, and that would indicate it to us the Gemara is now taking a totally new approach that would have answered both parts of the Mishnah. The absence of the word Ella, according to the Bali Tosafot, means that the Pikadom stira in the Mishnah is answered by Rava's differentiation, and the Gezel problem is answered by this difference of claimants versus, let's say, Yedei Shamayim. And therefore he says, Akach Nira, the The entire Mishnah is a case where he's coming to be Yotze Yedei Shemayim. And therefore, Lekach Bereisha, Davilei the Medak, in the Reisha where he should have been careful, Notein Lezemane Lezemane, Bebaladei Tzeit Yedei Shemayim. But, Beseifa, the Bekrach Echad, the Savior was given to him in one package, or the equivalent of one package, came into Davilei the Medak, since he shouldn't have been careful about it, Afilu Bale Tzeit Yedei Shemayim Enu Chayav. Even if he wants to be Yotze Yedei Shemayim, he has no obligation because he never needed to know the information. He was never responsible for that information. And therefore, according to Rabbi Tarfon, in the ratio of the Mishnah, why did it mention that I owe one of your father's money? The Rabuta, it's a Chiddush. Tafilu Shema v'Shema. Even when there's a Shema v'Shema, no telling the Kalachad v'Chad, but it's Yedei Shemayim. And you give it to each party, let's say Yedei Shemayim, even though nobody has a definitive claim over here. Ula Rabbi Akiva, Nakat Aviv. And right, according to Rabbi Akiva, he mentioned that he was from the father's the deposit. The mashma shem v'shema, v'kach enu chayav, ela letzeit yedei shemayim. Because according to Rabbi Akiva, the only reason you're obligated to pay over here is because you want to be yotze yedei shemayim. And then, in the seifa, where it doesn't say, your father's deposited the money with me, that is a rebuta, that even though there is a tanat bari, he is patur, let's say Yedei Shemayim, even according to Rabbi Kiva, because he wasn't a posheya. He didn't need to know the information. And therefore, even to be Yotze Yedei Shemayim, he has no obligation over here. And therefore, and Tosva concludes, V'lo mechayiv Rabbi Kiva Medina, ela bari v'shema. Rabbi Kiva says you're only obligated min adin to return money when there's a definitive claim and you answer, I don't know. V'heichad avilei the medak. And you were responsible to know the information. Aval b'shema v'shema, if it's maybe and maybe, both parties are making a maybe claims, afilu b'shnei krichot, even if it was deposited with him separately, enu chayav, ela letzeit yedei shemayim. In that case, you only have an obligation, letzeit yedei shemayim, v'echad ulavilei medak, and certainly in a case where he didn't need to know the information, patur afilu letzeit yedei mishamayim, afilu b'bari v'shema. Then you don't even have obligation to letzeit yedei shemayim, b'bari v'shema. And so what Tosafot is pointing out is that the case in the Seifa, where they deposited 100 and 200, even though both of them are coming with definitive claims and saying you owe me 200. And his response is Shema, Bari v'Shema, Rabbi Akiva says normally that you are Chayav. But why are you not Chayav over here? Because it was deposited in one unit to you. So you didn't need to know the information. Since you didn't know the need to know the information, you're not obligated. But not only are you not obligated, you're not even obligated, let's say, Yidei Shamayim, because there was no obligation on you whatsoever. That means in the latter part of the Mishnah, even, let's say, Yidei Shamayim, you put the 100 in the middle and let them work it out. In the ratio where it was your responsibility, even though it was Shema and Shema, and you had a responsibility to know it, there, Rabbi Akiva says, you're not Chayav min adin because it's only a Shema claim. But, let's say Yidei Shamayim, you will be Chayav, and you'll have to deal with it. So what Tosafot says in the end is that the entire Mishnah is a cases of, let's say, Yidei Shamayim. And in doing so, he says that Rova's position stands in the end, because that will be the differentiating factor between the Pikadon and the Reisha, and the Pikadon and the Seifa. The difference in Gezel is because Gezel in our Mishnah is, let's say, Yidei Shamayim. Gezel from the other source, Echad Michamisha, that's a totally different source, and that source is talking about Me'ikar Adin, rather than, let's say, Yidei Shamayim. And now the Gemara continues, Amar Mar, Hotam de Kotovile, over there, they're making a claim against him, meaning but the five and the one, they're making claim against him. Bahala Matoin, what does the Gazlan answer? You have five guys that show up and say, each one of them says, you stole 100 from me, and what is the Gazlan's response? Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Hala Shel Teik, Rav Yehuda Amarav says that the Gazlan is silent. Rav Matna Amarav, Hala Tzoveach. No, he's screaming that he doesn't owe the money to all five of them, that he only stole from one of them. Mandamar Hala Tzoveach, the one who says that the Gazlan is screaming and denying it, about Shtika Kohoda, that silence is acquiescence, and therefore he can't remain silent, because if he doesn't protest, we're going to assume that they're right in saying that he owes them money, and we're going to force him to pay all five of them because silence is an admission. Umandamar Allah shall take, the one who says that the Gazlan remains silent, shtika dahacha, love go dahu. This is not like your classic case of silence is acquiescence, because over here, Matzi Amarle, hai de shtike the kochad v'chad, he says the reason I'm silent to each claimant is damina, dilma haihu. I don't know who it is, maybe he is right. I can't deny each individual's claims because each individual by themselves might be right. In totality, all five of them can't be right. But to each claimant, I have no response because he might be right that I do owe him the money. So from here you see that not always is shtika kohoda'a. Silence is not always acquiescence. Silence is acquiescence depending on the context of the situation. You have to determine whether the silence should be deemed as an admission, or whether the silence is because the individual doesn't have enough information to answer or can't answer in the situation, and it's his silence is a result of his inability to respond, not because he's actually admitting or acquiescing to the claims that are made against him. So Amamar. So again, we're continuing with that. Braita meniach gzela b'neim umistalek. According to Rabbi Tarfon, he drops the gzela between them and he leaves it. V'shakli la kulu v'azle. So what do you let them do now? You let them all fight over it and walk off with it? I mean, this doesn't seem to be a proper solution to the problem. Again, in terms of him disgorging the gzela, it's a great answer. But in terms of him just throwing the money between them and letting them fight it out, that doesn't seem to make too much sense, because then you don't have any clarification of the situation. So we saw this back early in the Masechta with regards to Metziah. Kol safek hinuach, any case where you have a safek as to whether the object was placed there intentionally, v'chadchila lo itol, v'chadchila you shouldn't pick it up, v'im natal, if you did pick it up, lo yachzir, you don't return it. Meaning that here is an object without simanim on it. The object is sitting there and now you don't know if the balim intentionally placed it there, or they did not intentionally place it there. If they intentionally placed it there and then you pick it up, you've now, in a sense, caused a loss to them because there are no simanim. They won't be able to retrieve the object anymore. So your picking it up then causes the balim an inability to retrieve it. Therefore, we tell you don't pick it up. But if you do pick it up, then you have no obligation to return it because there are no simanim and there's no way for the balim to make a claim. Again, the Tosafot over there discuss what exactly is the scenario where this object is placed. This object is in a place where it's going to get stolen or ruined. It's clear there that you should pick it up. If it's in a secure location, it's very clear that you should not pick it up, because then somebody obviously intentionally placed it there. So Tosafot spoke about it's in a quasi-secure location, a place where it's not necessarily going to get ruined or stolen, but it's not necessarily clear that it was intentionally placed there. So that type of location that is quasi-secure, that's where we have this question. And the Rabbi Abba Bar Zavda Marav says, don't pick it up. Because once you pick it up without simanim, there's no chance the balim have a retrieval or can retrieve the item. Whereas if you leave it, there might be a case they'll come back and they'll find it there. Secondly, if you do pick it up, then you don't have to give it back because there are no simanim. There's no way for the claimant to tell you the object's simanim and to get it back from you. So our case is similar, which is over here, he has an object which has a safek surrounding it. If he goes ahead and gives it back, then what has he done? We just said here, if you have no simanim or you have no proper evidence of who the owner is, you don't give it back. You keep it. So that should be the same case over here. He has money, which he knows belongs to one of these five individuals, but he doesn't know which individual. So for him to simply disgorge it or throw it out, he has no obligation to do such because, or he shouldn't be doing such because nobody has enough evidence to take it away from him. So in this case, why does we say that he just throws it out to them and lets them fight over it? The answer, the Gemara says, is Amar Rav Safra v'yaniach. Safra says, when we say that he puts it down, we don't mean that he throws it to them, ela v'yaniach, in that he gives it over to the Beit Din, or that he holds onto it until the issue is cleared up. Meaning that v'yaniach means that he simply can't use it anymore. He puts it into an escrow, basically, or sets it aside until the issue is clarified. So similar to the case of Aveda, which is that you don't have to return it because of the fact that you don't know if it's going to get to its rightful owner that way, but you do have to set it aside or make sure that it's segregated some way, that you're disgorging the gezel, you're willing to return it. Someone's got to clarify who the right party is to get it. Similar to the Aveda, because over there you also have a safek as to whether it was Yeush Shalomidat. And when did the Yeush happen, and whether you're entitled to keep it. So when you picked it up, if the Balim intentionally left it there, they didn't have Yeush until they came back and found that you had taken it already. If that's the case, then it's in your possession improperly. So there you don't return it, but you may not necessarily be able to utilize it because of that question. Now, if you know for sure that there is Yeush, because it's been there for a long time, or whatever reason, then you can keep it and use it. All right, so now the Gemara says, Amar Lei Abaye L'Rava, Mi Amar Rabbi Akiva, Lo zoa derech motzioto mide avera, ad shishalem gzela l'kol chad v'chad. So Rabbi Akiva makes a statement. This is in that case where five people are making a claim against him, and the one guy says, I know I stole from one of you, but I don't know whom. Rabbi Akiva argues on Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Tarfon says, v'yaniach, he throws it out. Now we just learned that doesn't mean he throws it out. I mean, he keeps it in escrow until they determine who the proper owner is. Rabbi Akiva says, you're not going to be yotzei yidei shemaim in that case because you're not going to get it back to the nigzal. That's what we said before. There are two parts to the disgorgement of gzela. One is removing the gzela from your possession. The second part is the hashava, is returning it to the individual. So Rabbi Tarfon clearly believes that once you've given up and disgorged the item and presented it to those individuals who technically could be the nigzal, you've discharged your obligation in terms of disgorging and hashava, because one of them is the rightful owner. They have to work it out between them, but they have knowledge that you have disgorged the money already and that they can get to the money. They just have to work out how to get to the money. Rabbi Akiva says that's not enough. Hashava means that you literally get it back into the hand of the owner. And therefore he says over here, you're not yotzei yidei shemaim in this case, because yes, you disgorged the gezela. Yes, technically the hashabah is available, but in the end, you haven't done hashabat gzela. And if you want to do hashabat gzela, I mean, ikar din, we tell you to pay all five parties. If you want to make sure that you got the money back to the nigzal's hands, you should pay all five of them. And that's what Rabbi Akiva suggests over here. Alma, from here, mitzveika mafkinim mamona. Lo amrinu uki mamona b'cheskat marei. Again, here we're asking, wait, over here you see that you're able to cause the disgorgement of money, even though the person who has the money is bichazaka, that it's his money, and yet we're forcing him to pay out more than he actually owes or stuff that he's in possession of. Viramini, is that really true? Nafala bayit alav v'alimo. We had a house that collapsed. In the house were both a mother and a son. Depending on who passed away first will have implications in terms of who is the Yoresh. If the son passed away first, then the mother's possessions remained with her, and she has no Yoresh now. She has no inheritor. Since she has no inheritor, the money stays with her, and the relatives of the woman would be entitled to those monies or to what she owned. On the other hand, if the woman passed away first, then the son inherited his mother, and the son in inheriting his mother now would pass all of that Yerusha to the inheritors of the son, and the woman's inheritors or relatives would be out anything. They wouldn't get anything or entitled to anything. So over here, Nafala Bayit Delav Alimo, Yoshea ben Omrim, the ones who would inherit the son say, Ha'em Meita Rishona. Obviously, they say that the mother died first because that's to their advantage, because then they'll not only get the property or the possessions of the son, they'll also get the property or possessions of the mother because they were passed to the son. But Yoshea Aim Omrim, the other hand, the inheritors or the relatives of the mother say, Ha'ben Meita Rishona, that the son died first because then the mother retained her ownership over those properties. Elu ve'elu modim. They both agree. Now, Elu ve'elu is Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel there argue about what the din is. There are a series in Baba Batra, which we'll get to, of these Mishnayot, of scenarios where we have different parties, and there's a safek as to which party passed away first, and then you have to deal with the Yerusha and the claimants that are coming to take possession of the estate. Who does it belong to, depending on what happened in the situation? There's a machloket between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel as to what governs. Beit Shammai says yachloku, that they split it. Since it's a safek, there's no way to know in the end, because we'll never know whether the son or the mother died first. Yachloku. Beit Hillel says nechasim b'chezkatan, that their nechasim remain in their position of chazakah. The Gemara in Baba Batra deals with what that means. What is in whose possession and who has a chazakah on what properties? And they'll divide it up along the lines of the chazakah. What we say over here is elu ve'elu modim. Both Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel agree over here, shiachloku, that they divided up. Ve'amar Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva on that statement that says that both of them agree that you split it, mudeh ani bezu, I agree here, shanechasim b'chezkatan, that the nechasim are b'chezkatan, the position of Beit Hillel. Rashi says over here that Rabbi Akiva, even though he is from Beit Shammai, he nevertheless agrees to Beit Hillel's position in this case, which is in Echasim B'chezkatan. Rashi's position is very difficult. You can already see that in the Balei HaTosafot. Other Rishonim point out and prove the fact that Rabbi Akiva is not a member of Beit Shammai, and he has more to do with Beit Hillel than to do with Beit Shammai. And so therefore the Modeh over here that Rashi claims is, oh, I admit over here that I'm not keeping my position that I have in other places, which Rashi claims is like Beit Shammai Yachloku. Over here, I disagree and say nechasim b'chezkatan. So that's the way Rashi reads it. You can see the Balei Tosafot who disagree, and they say rather, Ella agav d'shana la'el, elu ve'elu modim, tana hacha modeh ani. Meaning that the reason Rabbi Akiva uses Lashon HaModeh is not because he's admitting or changing his mind versus what his previous opinion was. It's rather that they said, we, elu ve'elu, both Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, modeh, agree or admit in this case, this is the din. Rabbi Akiva comes along and says, no, I admit that the din is this way. Not that he's admitting or changing his mind from the other cases, but simply he's responding to their admission or their agreement in this case. So he's saying modeh as a response to their modeh or modim that was there, but not that it has any implications about his position in the other situations. Gemara says, wait a minute. So now Rabbi Akiva's position over here is nechatzim b'chezkatan. So there, the nechasim remain in the possession of the party who's in possession of them. So now, why in our case, all of a sudden, as Rabbi Akiva say, have them give up five payments to pay all these individuals up, even though it's clear that he has chazakah, he is in possession of this money, and there's no reason for him to give up the money. Why are we forcing him to give up money that otherwise should belong to him and is in his possession? So Malay, hotam shema v'shema. Wait, there's a big difference over here. In the case of the house falling, nobody has a definitive claim. No matter whether it's the Yoshea Ben or the Yoshea Aim, they can say whatever they want to say. Nobody even has the information. There's no way to know who passed away first. If that's the case, it's a Shema V'Shema. Both of them have maybe claims. Gazal Echad Mechamisha Bari V'Shema. Over there, you have a definitive claim coming from the five. Each one of them is definitively saying, you owe me money. The Gazlan is saying, Shema, maybe I do owe you, maybe I owe you, maybe I owe you. It's a bari v'shema. And that's what we said before for Rabbi Akiva, that when you have a case of bari v'shema, that's what Tosafot pointed out, that's when Rabbi Akiva thinks that you are obligated to pay. Now, whether you're obligated or let's say Yidei Shemayim has to do with what your responsibility is in the case. In the case where you're responsible to know, then in that case, it's a chiyuv mi'ikar adin. On the other hand, if the Shema v'Shema case, mi'ikar adin, he wouldn't have to pay according to Rabbi Akiva. The reason that you do, let's say Yidei Shemayim, is because you should have known. If it is a case where you're not responsible to know, then even if he wants to be Yosei Yidei Shemayim, he has no obligation because he never needed to know the information, and he was never responsible for that information. So over here, it seems like the Gazlan, you would have a responsibility to know who you stole from, and therefore, in order to return the money properly, you would have to know who you stole it from. So it is your responsibility, and therefore it seems that according to Rabbi Akiva, this is Me'ikar Adin. That even though he uses the terminology that he's not Yotzei Yidei Shemayim, it seems like Me'ikar Adin, he has to return the property in order to accomplish Veshivet Gzela Asher Gazal, and Me'ikar Adin will have to pay all five of them. We're going to compel him to pay all five of them, not just when he volunteers to pay all five of them because of the Bari V'Shema claim that exists over here, and the responsibility of the Gazlan to know who he took it from. Where it says, Va'amatnit no'ocha. Wait a minute, what about our Mishnah? Amar l'shnaim gazalti le'achad mikem maneh. In a case where he says, I stole from one of you two 100 zuz. D'shema v'shema hu. That's the case v'shema shema. The Gazlan says, I stole from one of you. I don't know which one of you. Each of the two parties that were stolen from also says, I don't know if you stole from me. So now you have a shema against the shema. V'ktani noten le'zemaneh le'zemaneh. And yet, we still say, pay each one of them maneh. You just told me that Rabbi Akiva only believes that there's an obligation to pay when there's a bari v'shema. In the Mishnah, we have a case of shema v'shema, and yet we're still saying that there's an obligation to pay. Again, you have to ask the question, didn't we say before that the Mishnah is authored by Rabbi Tarfon? That's the case. It's not a problem for Rabbi Akiva. Umimai, Rabbi Akiva yi. How do you know that Rabbi Akiva is the author of the Mishnah? Diktani Allah da'ai. Because it says, on that statement of Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Tarfon's statement, which qualifies our Mishnah, meaning that, says Modeh Ayah Rabbi Tarfon. Says Rabbi Tarfon is Modeh. In this case, Bo'omer l'shnayim gazalti achad mikem manev, any udeza mikem, v'chulei, that you have to pay back each one of them, l'man Modeh. Who is he admitting to? Meaning that when he says, I agree in this case that that's the halacha, who is he agreeing with? L'Rabbi Akiva bar plukte. It must be Rabbi Akiva, his counterparty, or the one who argues on him. Rabbi Akiva, in the case of stealing from one of five, says you pay them all back. Rabbi Tarfon says you put the money down, you don't pay them all back. Then it says, Rabbi Tarfon says, I agree in the case of our Mishnah, like you, Rabbi Akiva, that you pay all the parties together. Well, if he's agreeing with Rabbi Akiva, that means that Rabbi Akiva himself also believes that's the case. So Gemara says, Umimai d'shema v'shemahu. How do you know that it's a Shema and Shema case? Chado. First of all, d'lo k'tani tovim oto. Their claimants aren't coming and making claim against them. It says Modeh. Va'od hatani Rabbi Chia. And we have a bright of Rabbi Chia, which expands on our Mishnah. In there, it's explicit. Zeh omer eini yodea. V'zeh omer eini yodea. So in Rabbi Chia's bright, which recounts our Mishnah with more detail, there it says that each party explicitly says eini yodea. V'ha'o kimna la bebalitzeit yodei shemayim. Wait a minute. Didn't you already set up the Mishnah as a case of Balitzeit Yidei Shemayim? So that's why there's a difference over there. Rabbi Akiva, in the case, which is what I said before, with the one and the five, where there's a Bari and Shema claim, Rabbi Akiva there says, Me'ikar Adin, you have to pay it back. Because there's a Bari claim and a Shema claim, Me'ikar Adin, we're going to tell you, pay the money back and take it out. In our Mishnah, where it's a Shema of a Shema case, Me'ikar Adin, he wouldn't have to pay according to Rabbi Akiva. The reason that you do let's say Yidei Shemayim is because you should have known. You should have known the information. The fact that you should have known the information now makes you obligated, let's say Yidei Shemayim. So according to Rabbi Akiva, in a case of Shema v'Shema where you should have known, or it's your fault that you don't know, then you, let's say Yidei Shemayim, you pay each party. So that's what Tosafot had showed us before, that in the case of Gezel and the five guys are making a claim against him and he says, I don't know, in that case he pays all five of them Ikar Adin. In our Mishnah where he admits to stealing, and the other parties say, I don't know if you stole from me. So now you have a Shema and Shema. Over there, Me'ikar Adin, you don't have an obligation to repay. But let's say Yidei Shemayim, you do have an obligation to pay because of the fact you should have known. And since you should have known, it's your responsibility. And that makes it that, let's say Yidei Shemayim, you have to repay all parties. Amrele Ravina the Rabashi. So now we have a question on Rova's position. Umi Amar Rova kol b'shtei krichot havelei the meidak. Is it really true that Rova says that any time the packages are separate, that you have a responsibility to know from whom the package came? Va'ama Rova, didn't Rova say, v'itema Rav Papa, and some say it's Rova's Talmud, Rav Papa, which, and again, might be the same question, because Rav Papa is a Talmud of Rova, he should have had the same din, or the same position as his Rebbe. Hakol modim b'shnaim shivkidu etzel roeh. Everybody agrees, by two individuals who deposited animals with a shepherd, sheminiach roeh b'nehem u'mistalek. The roeh puts up his hands and says, you guys figure it out. So now, what is the scenario here by the roeh? Rashi says, interestingly enough, that the case here is a case where the two individuals come and deposit animals with the roeh. One of them gives him one animal, the other one gives him two animals. And they both come back afterwards and say, the two animals belong to me. V'hatam shtrei krichot ninu. Rashi says, that's the equivalent of two packages. V'afilu yifkidu ze bifnei ze. Even if they deposited one in front of the other, devara nirahu, something that is obvious, mimi v'yachad umimi v'yishnayim. So, in the case where the two parties come and deposit 300, one gives 200, one gives 100, and they give it the same time to the individual, there is no discrete item or discernibility. Money is fungible. It all looks the same. And therefore, there's no responsibility for him to know it, right? That's why there are no simanim by money. And therefore, he has no responsibility to differentiate. And that's why he's off the hook. In the case of the behemoth, where it's animals, two animals and one animal, it's each animal is unique. They're discrete objects. And he should have been able to differentiate. It's not like he got it in one bundle. And even if three animals came together, he still can differentiate the animals. That's what Rashi claims is the question of the Gemara over here. This is a case unlike the money, and it's considered to be shtei krichot. And yet over here we say that the roeh dumps it between them and walks away. But Rava says when you have shtei krichot, it's the responsibility of the party to know which one. If he doesn't, then he's on the hook for it. So that's a stira in Rava's position. That's the way Rashi explains it. You can already see here that the Balei Tosafot disagree with what he says, Perush Rashi, and then he brings Vikasha. He says it doesn't make sense at all what Rashi is saying. Ela Yesh Lamar, Tafiru Hifkidu Tleim Ze Bifnei Ze, Havalei the Medach, Telo Shayach the Meimar, Atun Lo Kabit Titun. You can't say over here that you guys weren't Makbid. Bisham Delo Yuchlu Le Takein, because the information, in a sense, is always public. In the case of the money, if you deposited the money secretly with this individual, or without anybody being there, no one else will know that the money is there. Unless the information is disclosed improperly, meaning that the person who's holding it gives the information away. Otherwise, nobody will know how much money you deposited with this individual, because it's a private affair. The other hand, Tosafot says, when you have animals that are deposited with a roeh, so the one guy goes and gives his animal over to the roeh. The next guy comes the subsequent day and gives over his animal. He goes, oh wait, you're watching animals already, you have these animals, who do they belong to? Then he gets information because that information is, in a sense, in the public domain, because you can see that he has animals from other parties. That means that you know that someone else deposited the money, even if you didn't do it together. So the key difference, those what says in the case of the monies, is that in the case of the monies, if you deposit it separately, it remains a private affair and nobody would know about it. When you come and bring it together, that clearly shows that you aren't makpid one on the other, or you don't worry about the other guy stealing your money. Because otherwise you should have done it separately. By the behemoth, you can't say if they both brought it on the same day, oh, you should have been more careful, brought it on a separate day. Because bringing it on a separate day won't solve your problem. Because the information is still in the public domain, because the fact that the shepherd walks around with those animals. And people are going to know that you have the animals, even if they weren't there when you deposited the animals with the shepherd. That's the way Balei Tosafot explains it. There is another Rashi in Bechorot that explains the case differently. And that's how it seems that the Musar Rishonim learned, is that they each deposited a tle with the roeh, and one of them died. And now they're coming to make a claim for it. And he says, I don't know which one of yours died. And they're each saying that mine's the live one, not the dead one. And so over there, he puts it between them and says, let's them work it out. So that's why the case, again, is different. Because by the case of the money, there's no way to own the information. That's why he's not responsible. By the case of the roeh, why is he allowed to put the animals? He got two separate animals for individuals. He should have known the difference. He should have known which one died and which one belongs to the other party. the fact that he doesn't know that information, we let him throw it back and leave it in their possession, seems to undermine Rava's position. The fact that we let him dump the issue back to the other parties seems to go against Rava's position. So Rava answers him, it's a case where they put it into his flock without him knowing, without his knowledge. I mean that the Roya is used to this. Maybe overnight people come and leave their animals with him, and then when they come to claim them, they pay him for it. But then the Roya has no idea who deposited what or has no way to differentiate the animals, and it's the equivalent of the case of two people bringing money together in a single package. It does what says, Lav Dafka Shalom Midato, that when they deposit it without the knowledge of the Roya, not literally without his knowledge, not when he was watching. They might have told him, we put two sheep in your corral over there, we're leaving them with you. But he never saw them put the two sheep in there. So he's not under an obligation to know which are each party's sheep that were placed in there. Again, if he just does it on a basis where they pay him when they come to claim their animals, that also could be the situation over here. Now, in this case, the reason that we allow him to disgorge the animal, as opposed to the cases before we say, hold on to the money or put it in escrow, is because there's a clear difference between the items. Money is inanimate, doesn't cost you anything. You simply keep it there until the proper claimant comes and claims it from the escrow account. There's no undertaking really by you in order to keep the money. Over here, if the roeh holds on to the animal until they clarify the situation, he's got to feed, take care of this animal until they figure it out. He has no interest in doing that. And that's why over here it says that the roeh dumps it to them and says, you guys deal with it, because he wants it out of his possession. He can't keep feeding the animal until these guys figure it out. He might have it there for the rest of his life. In both cases, the solution is that he has to give it back. But he leaves it until they figure it out. But how he leaves it makes a difference here, because this is the animal versus the money. Okay, now the Gemara says, Vitzricha, our Mishnah writes that you have Shnei Kelim, and then it also wrote about the Kesef, Matayim and Maneh. Why do I need both of them? Gemara says, Vitzricha, Dishmeinan hach kamaita, if you only told me about the case of the money, Bahai Kamrei Rabbanan, over there the Rabbanan say, Mishum Deleka Pseida, because in that case there's no loss. Of a Baha Deika Pseida, over here, where there is a loss, the gadol of the larger kli, emamodele the Rabbi Yossi. Maybe they would agree with Rabbi Yossi that you don't split it. This is what compels Rashi and the Mishnah to explain that they broke the bigger kli. Otherwise, what type of loss are you talking about with the bigger kli? Rashi is saying there's a loss because you broke it. So now the kli is no longer functional, and that's why there's a loss. Maybe they wouldn't agree in that case that you split it, or you pay the smaller kli out of the bigger kli. That's why Rashi uses the word shaber. According to those that say you monetize it, there's still a pseudo, which is, in the end, he's lost the kli. He might have the monetization of the kli, but the kli itself is now gone because you broke it down and gave the money of the smaller one to him. And the money of the bigger kli is now in escrow, but the kli itself is now completely gone. Now, even if you end up with all the money, you may not be able to buy the kli back. So that is the pseudo that is involved here. On the other hand, in the case of the kli, if you had just brought the case of the kelim, over there, Rabbi Yossi says, don't give it back because of the pseudo of the gadol, the loss in the gadol. By the monies, maybe you would agree with the Rabbanan and Sricha. Rabbi says, what type of answer is that? The reasoning of Rabbi Yossi has nothing to do with the pseudo or not pseudo. Rabbi Yossi's reasoning, he wants the cheater to lose money. So how could you argue that only in the case of Kli does he want the Ramai to lose out? And there you're going to lose the kleis. So therefore, that's why I say over there, don't break it. But in the case of monies, I say, you know what? Let the Ramai get his money back. No. The whole reasoning of Rabbi Yossi has to do with the Ramai losing. It should be irrespective of money and kli. Therefore, the Gemara says, this trichuta makes no sense. It can't be a tension between the Rabban and Rabbi Yossi, because Rabbi Yossi's position is clear in all cases. You don't give it back, because we want the Ramai to lose. So therefore, he would have the same position of money and kli. You would not have thought otherwise. So now, what is the tzrichuhata? Elo tarvayu the rabbanan itztich. We need both of them, the rabbanan. Velo zu av zu ktani. Meaning that the Mishnah is a literary form or style. Truthfully, had you written the kelim first, we would have known about the money. Because once you tell me by the kelim, the rabbanan say you split it, even though there's going to be a loss to the kli gadol, and yet they still say split it, or give katan to each of them and then leave the rest in escrow, then certainly by money, where there's no loss, they would say it. So had you written in the case of kli first, you wouldn't have had to write the case of money. But the Mishnah wrote the case of money first, and therefore it says, lo zu avzu. Not only in the case of money do the Rabbanan say that you split the money and give the equal portion to each of them, the 100 to each of them, leave the 100 in escrow. But even in the case of Kli Katan, Kli Gadol, Abzu, in that case, they still say it, even though there's going to be a hefsay to the Kli Gadol. Whether you think like Rashi or the Ritva, there's going to be some loss to the Kli Gadol. Nevertheless, they still hold their opinion over there. Okay? We're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Lamed Chet Amud Aleph.